I'm Jan Suk Fong Lee.
And I'm Dina Del Bucchia.
And this is Can't Lit.
Can't Lit. Talk about books and stuff.
Hello. Hello. Welcome to Can't Lit.
Hi.
Hi, Jen.
Hi, Dina.
How are you?
I'm well. I ate an apple slice. That feels like a triumph. My tummy's been unsettled.
Yeah. You need to do that brat diet.
Oh, bananas, rice, apples,
toast.
That sounds gross.
You don't have to eat them all at the same time.
Okay. Like not in a big sandwich.
No, you have to put them all on top of each other in a big pile.
Like what was that comic strip? The guy who made the big sandwiches? Dilbert? Dagbert? No.
Dagwood?
Dagwood!
From Blondie?
I think so.
Blondie comics?
Maybe. He made really big sandwiches. That's all I remember.
I feel like also lots of cartoon, especially old timey cartoons, people would make a big sandwich, but they would do it like they were shuffling dice.
Yeah.
Shuffling cards. And they would shuffle the sandwich bits together.
And then they'd magically squish it and it would fit in their mouth.
Yeah, and they'd be like, this is delicious.
I don't know why that's not real. That should be real.
I agree. It should be real. And I love it.
Yeah. How are you, Dina?
I'm also good. I ate part of a cookie. And I liked that a lot. And an apple slice.
Yeah.
I just didn't want to be chewing on the mic for you listeners. So that is why I stopped eating.
We are constantly snacking. It's true.
We're always snacking. So we really have to be careful. Mm-hmm. And I know that I need to edit out chewing sounds sometimes. So today, Jen and I are going to try and do some episodes this year where we talk about different subjects, topics, themes in the world of the literary, but also maybe other stuff that we haven't decided yet.
Yeah, who knows?
Because, this is a literature podcast.
It
but
is?
But also it's a tangent-based podcast. So it's really important that we get our tangents in.
Mm-hmm.
So today's subject is baby writers, being baby writers. Back in the baby.
Low so long ago.
Low those many years ago. I just realized as I was preparing for today's podcast that my first publication was 10 years ago, which is not really that long.
Happy anniversary.
It's long, but it's not that long.
It isn't that long because it can take many years to write a book anyway. And people go many years between books. So it's actually not that long ago in the grand scheme of publishing.
No, not at all.
No.
But yeah, my first publication, and it was after many tries of trying to get things published. And it was in Event magazine.
Oh, that's exciting. Yeah. Happy anniversary.
Yeah.
Thanks, Event.
And it was one of the poems that was published was my Lindsay Lohan poem. And one of the other ones was an Otter poem because I was working on those manuscripts in tandem.
Staying true to her brand since 2009.
Yeah. So, I'd been working on those for a while and really happy that Lindsay found a home.
She deserves a home.
And the otter found a home. Two creatures that I want to be housed out in the world.
Who are often misunderstood.
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's my theme. Mm-hmm. That's the common theme that runs through my work.
Misunderstood.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm into
creatures.
It. Yeah.
With reputations. They have reputations.
They got reputations. Mm-hmm. I don't give a damn about my reputation. Rosie. Just shouting her out.
Yeah, she's sleepy.
She would be great in a band.
Rosie?
Yeah.
She'd be the hype man.
She totally would.
Or hype dog, rather.
She'd be the hype dog,
yeah,
for sure.
Just on the side of the stage dancing.
For sure. Although I had done some other things before that. I had written some plays.
Did you write plays?
Well, I had some, when I was quite young.
Mm.
And then I did Brave New Playwrights when I was an undergrad.
Oh, and so that
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
How was that?
Was good.
I don't know.
Also on brand, in the play, there was a taxidermy squirrel.
Yay!
So again, I really haven't grown very much. It's really important for everyone to understand where we're at.
I never did Brave New Playwrights at UBC. I wrote a play and it was terrible.
Oh.
It was just sad and nobody moved around the stage. And
everyone was just talking to each other quietly.
Yeah, no, it was like parallel monologues. It was awful.
Oh.
They didn't speak to each other.
Oh.
It was
I feel like there's a way to make that work.
No, it was I'd read too much Beckett. I was I'm going to be like Beckett.
Yeah.
This seems right. This seems like something I should be doing as a, 21-year-old Chinese Canadian woman who doesn't care about Beckett at all.
Yeah.
It was terrible. Nobody wanted it.
Yeah. I feel like I also had read too much Beckett when I wrote this play, but I very intentionally was like, this will be a comedy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mine was not funny at all.
So, well, by the time this comes out, I'll have released the third very important series of photos that I took for my book.
They're great photos.
And I think you're really going to enjoy them. So Jen, tell me about Baby Writer Jen.
Baby Writer Jen, my first publication. Oh, this is a good one. So my first publication in a journal was a student journal when I was like 17. And the news came to my English teacher in high school first. And she told me, and it happened that she told me, and she said, well, I submitted the news to the people who read the announcements over the morning PA system. And I was like really thrilled because I didn't play sports or anything. And I wasn't in like the math Olympics. So I never got shouted out on the PA system. And I was super excited about that. But then as it turns out, on that same day, this girl who was also in my grade won a Much Music dance contest, and she got a role in a Mitsu music video. No, really. So they didn't announce my news. They announced that this girl was going to be in a Mitsu music video because she won a Much Music dance contest.
I can't believe she was going to be in a Mitsu video. That is exciting.
She was in a Mitsu video.
That is exciting.
She was legitimately in a Mitsu video. And like, can I just say though, like I got really upset at the time.
Of course you should have been upset.
I'm like, this is a school. This is where I learned how to read and write. We don't learn to be in Mitsu music videos. Anyway, that was me as a
baby. I mean, I hope now there are classes for young people on how to be in a Mitsu music video. I mean, I hope we've made it that far.
Yeah, I mean,
I hope we've bye-bye Mon Cowboyed our way into the future.
I actually told this story to somebody recently and they asked me what happened to her. And I said, well, she became a Grizzly girl. Like she was cheerleader for the Grizzlies.
When the Vancouver Grizzlies were a basketball team, an NBA team in Vancouver for a brief period of time.
Yeah.
Big country.
Yeah. And then one day after the Grizzlies had left, I was walking by the Bay downtown and they have those display windows like that are ground level to Granville Street. And it was springtime and they had a big spring display and she was standing in a pot wearing flower petals on her head dancing. And I felt kind of bad.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's the exact kind of character I would write about.
The one in the pot,
the
right?
One in the pot.
The one in the pot. Yeah. And now she's a realtor. It's fine.
Ugh, so she definitely sucks. I am so mean. Sorry, realtors, but you're just life ruiners, and I know you can't help it, but it's just who you are.
Also, Baby Writer Jen, who was 16 at that time, had a very, like, pedantic idea about what feminism was. So I was really on a rampage about this whole Mitsu music video bullshit. You know.
I also at the time was like, it was confusing. I wasn't raised Catholic, but other people were in our town. And so everyone was always like talking about women's rights and all this stuff. And I'm like, I don't know what to believe. What's a baby? What's not a baby? Who's this? What's that over there? And like eventually, thanks to, you know, whole Bikini Kill, L7, all these cool people.
Thank God.
Thank God we were able to get magazines so I could read, because at the time that's all you had.
Shout out Sassy.
Thanks to Sassy. Thank you to
Jane.
Yeah, Jane. But I also would read like every music magazine. Like I would read AP, Press.
Yeah.
I would read Rolling Stone. I would read everything.
Interview was one of my favorites at that age.
I also, my mom still to this day always gets People and Us.
Oh, you read like those? The paper ones?
Mm-hmm.
Aw, Terry.
Terry's not really like online that much. She's a Facebook lurker because she doesn't have an account, but she uses my dad's account. She's a real lurker.
Hi, Terry.
Yeah.
Hi, Mom.
She's definitely not listening.
What about Dina as a baby writer, though?
So, yeah, like when I was young, when I was very young, like 8, I used to write plays all the time and then make kids in the neighborhood act them out, and I would make us do crafts to like...
Like make
masks and stuff. Yep.
This is like Little Women.
But they didn't like doing it, obviously.
Oh, no.
So it didn't always work out. Sometimes it did. I also definitely dressed up a lot of young boys in drag.
Oh, excellent.
One time one of their parents came over, this dad came over and got really mad.
Really?
Yeah, because toxic masculinity and his child was dressed. He came over and his child was dressed like a girl and he flipped out.
How old was this child? Not that it matters.
Oh, he was like 4.
Well, who cares?
I, obviously, this very insecure, terrible man. So, stuff like that. I was always very into the theatrical part of it. I wrote a lot of poems when I was a kid. Like, in second grade, I got asked to read a poem at a little thing that we did. It was, like, after school and all the parents, like, parents' night. Yeah. And I read a poem about a kitten. Aww. That was like my, yeah, I know. Again, very on brand, writing poems about animals.
Yeah.
Unchanged. Have barely matured. So, yeah, then into high school, I was definitely writing poetry, writing short stories, writing plays. I'm going to Powell River. I think I'll have already come back by the time this episode is out. But, yeah, there used to be this BC Festival of the Arts before arts funding was cut in the early aughts. This was in the late 90s. And, yeah, we did a play called Carry Me Over the Threshold, Super Hunk. That was about Lois Lane's bridal shower.
That's a very good title.
And I was Wonder Woman in the play. Mm-hmm. And it was very fun. And, yeah, it got selected for a youth rights anthology. And for years afterwards, sometimes other schools would do the play.
That's great.
Because it was, like, distributed to all of the schools. Yeah. Because, obviously, they would all want to, like, of course everyone wanted to play, you know, like a superhero.
Yes.
Or Lois Lane. Lois Lane was very bumbling in this production. She just wanted everything to be perfect, and she was very, like, buttoned up. And then we got her drunk, and then she was, like, really free.
Well.
Yeah.
You do know my friend, Orion Kidder, is Margo Kidder's nephew.
I know. I love
it. Yeah, yeah.
It's great.
And he played Superman in high school multiple times for plays
and
stuff.
I love it.
It was great.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I did undergrad at UBC.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did too. And then, like, I guess then I was only really writing poetry. I mean, I wrote other things, plays and, like, short stories and stuff, but I was really only writing poetry. And it was one of those, like, I did not have very much success with publication from the time I was, like, 18 to, I want to say, 26 or 7.
But were you submitting during that time?
I was submitting.
I was barely submitting during that time.
I was submitting because it was snail mail. Like, you couldn't, there was no email, really.
No.
So as soon as a package came back rejected, I'd send it right out again. As long as they didn't write on it, I would just send it right out again. Because all of those poems, I was a student at UBC, had been workshopped. I had no interest in working on them anymore, and I don't think they needed it. I still don't think they needed it. But I had very little.
I don't
Almost
think I
nothing.
Submitted anything until I had graduated from undergrad. Maybe even after that. Like, I felt like I took a break. I was definitely not. I didn't know if I would keep writing at all. I probably started submitting when I was 23 and then had zero success until 2009.
I think I had
2003 to 2009.
One publication when I was like 22, like in 98, and then nothing until like after I started writing The End of East. So probably nothing until like 2002 or 2003.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And I kept sending stuff out over and over and over again.
Because I grew up somewhere where I wasn't really exposed to any literary magazines. All of that stuff was totally new to me as soon as I started studying writing. I was like, I don't know what you do. When I was younger, like, I remember submitting some stuff to a contest in the Trail Daily Times one time.
Yeah.
And that was like what I knew. But before that, you know, that's why I feel like I've always been very much about producing my own stuff, because I did that a lot when I was younger, like being a part of little theater groups and putting on your own stuff, writing your own stuff because you weren't able to find things that were interesting. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of like thinking about established journals and all that stuff also was very intimidating to me.
It was scary. And I mean, I will say that I got a lot of rejections. I still have the file folder upstairs of all of my paper rejections, and I kept them because I like to remember who I'd sent the stuff to or whatever. But I remember getting a really lovely rejection from Canadian Literature in like,
oh, that's nice,
1999 or 2000. And I can't remember the name of the editor who was there at the time, but he was lovely. He wrote me the nicest rejection. And he didn't even say that my poems didn't work. It just wasn't the thing that they did. And, you know, he, whatever. And, I feel like it was a good practice, even though the success rate wasn't super high. It was pretty low, actually super, super, super low. And it wasn't, when I started writing The End of East, I started submitting excerpts of that fiction pieces to magazines, and I got a couple of those published, which was, it felt like a miracle to me, because my poetry was, people were lukewarm on them, you know, on it as, at best at that time. But yeah, and then I started doing those excerpts from The End of East, and people seemed to really be into them. And then it became the novel, right?
As they should.
Well, yeah, as you
they should.
I'm a goddamn genius.
Yeah, like when I was in my like early to mid-20s, before I went to grad school, I didn't even think that I could write a novel, could write any, you know, like I had short stories and I'd been sort of working on them over time, but I wasn't in any way committed like the way I see people who are that age now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I actually think I would have benefited a lot from social media at that time.
Oh, hello, listeners. That's my dryer. I forgot that I had it on.
It's the dryer. So please enjoy the dryer.
Yeah.
But I feel like I would have done, as an extrovert, as a person who like is really into reaching out to people, I would have done better if I had not just been alone at home. Fake writing.
I think social media, you know, for baby writers now gives you so much more of a sense of community, so much more. Like people are very open about, I submitted to this and I got this rejection. That feels better. So yeah. I had no idea.
And before I had gone to grad school, like I had my writing group, which is amazing. The Lying Bastards, we've been meeting since 2004 and I was very lucky that they let me into their group. And when we formed, it was amazing. And obviously we've been meeting this whole time, but aside from them, yeah, like, and they all were, you know, had been doing way more work than I had. And so I really felt like a baby writer in that group, which wasn't bad. I was grateful to be able to have people who were older and wiser and had totally different perspectives on everything to help me figure out what the fuck I was doing most of the time. But yeah, I think that I would have, aside from the fact that I probably also would have, like, I don't know, made way more mistakes because, as we talked about earlier, like, you know, my worldview was not as enlightened or smart, like many
nuanced.
Of us. Like, I think that I would have made a lot of mistakes.
I think
I would have been canceled a lot of times.
My writing group has been together since 2002. And June Hutt and Mary Novick are... we come from totally different backgrounds and ages and all of that stuff. Super useful. You don't always agree about things and you don't, and that's okay. But how would I know? And they're both like, Mary, for example, has a really classical sort of English literature background, which has been so helpful to me. Like she'll say things like, this is biblical. And I'm like, what? I'm a dummy. And, you know, and then June has a real practical turn of mind and this is all super useful. So part of what keeps us going is community. And it's really, I think, very difficult to write in isolation. And I know that a lot of writers are like introverts and they're not like people who it's easy for them to go out and meet people, but being online helps a whole ton if you're an introvert to find people that you
can. I really hope that it does for people. Yeah. So how did you outside of that start to find community? Was it difficult? Tell us about that whole experience.
Yeah. So I did like a, back in the day, UBC had a continuing studies creative writing program called Booming Ground. And this is early days of online learning peoples. So it was like a mixed residency situation. So we were at UBC for, I think, a week or 2 weeks physically. And then we did 9 months of online workshopping. And that's where I met Mary and June and some other people. But it was actually the very first time I had brought The End of East to anybody in a situation where it would be workshopped. And it felt very scary to me. The End of East at that point was like maybe in second draft, early days. And I remember my mentor that for that period was Thomas Wharton. Shout out to Thomas Wharton. We love him. He's in Edmonton. He's lovely. And he read it and I remember we had this one-on-one meeting and he's like, what do you want to know from me? And I'm like, does it suck? And he started laughing. He's like, oh my God, no, it doesn't suck. I said, just be straight. Should I just stop right now? And he's like, no. And it felt so affirming to me. And at that time it must've been super rough. It wasn't a good novel at that point. And that's where that community started for me, understanding that it felt so good to be around other writers and wanting and being motivated to continue it. And I've never really stopped since that. And that was 2002, I guess. Yeah. What about you?
So I like what you said, though, about, you know, that question, because I think that's something that's this, it's not specific. It's this blanket question that people worry about. Does this suck? Should I keep going? And I think to have any level of encouragement, especially from people you respect, is like really important because you might not continue otherwise. You might not. Mm-hmm. But I think if you have that available to you and you are able to accept it, like that's really amazing. Before grad school, I knew stuff was going on, but like I didn't really know about events. Again, pre-social media, like I wasn't connected to people. I knew there was stuff happening in the city, but I felt like there were these two camps. There were like the UBC grads who were becoming famous,
yeah,
and everyone loved them. And they were kind of like these shining stars. And then on the poetry side, there was sort of the Kootenai School of Writing,
yeah,
which to me was, again, extremely intimidating. I was like, there's nothing these people are going to, you know, want from me that'll be in. They were very intellectual, very academic, very smart. I didn't feel like I in any way was like that.
No, I get it. I don't have an MFA, so this was a very...
But an MFA isn't academic.
No, it's
not. An MFA is a craft, to me, a craft-based learning experience. So it's not that you're not studying, but it's not an English degree. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that came more from that whole world. Yeah, people who were had PhDs or were going to eventually get PhDs, and I was like, that's definitely not for me. I'm not smart enough to be around these people. I'm a bumpkin forever is how I mostly think of myself. I'm like, you know, I just rolled out of the countryside. And so, again, I know some people now that were part of Kootenai School of Writing, and they're great friends, and I think they're wonderful. But I was just like, that is not a thing that I'm ever going to be able to be a part of, which is fine. But yeah, grad school for me really was the starting point, and also working in bookstores, meeting people that way. So it was mostly when I started to get involved with events or get involved with selling books at events, doing things like that, that I actually started to meet people and talk to people and feel somewhat comfortable placing myself as a person who was a writer. Because for a long time, when you work in a bookstore, everyone just looks at you like you're a bookseller.
Yeah, you're the hired help. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't have anything to offer, et cetera, et cetera. And so being in the MFA program and hosting Locution, which is the reading series there, really helped a lot. Because then people were like, you're really good at hosting events. You should do this more. And I was like, oh, maybe I should. So kind of trying to pursue that stuff a bit more.
I think this leads to like a question that, you know, I think that emerging writers think about a lot is like, how do you figure out what your voice is? But it's bigger than that. It's not just your writerly voice. It's also your role. What is your position in this? What can you do in this community? And what are you taking from the community? What are you giving? What are you receiving?
Yes.
And I think, you know, like it starts with voice. Like for me, like similar to you, I knew that I couldn't write like David Foster Wallace, and I didn't want to. And I knew that those things were not possible for me. So trying to figure out if I'm not Amy Tan and I'm not David Foster Wallace, where am I? And that took years. Years.
It takes years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like years. I read so many things that I liked that I didn't like. I read things that I was told I should like.
Yeah.
That eventually I realized, oh, this was actually terrible. And working in a bookstore, the prize culture is constantly on you because that's what your displays are comprised
and
of.
Like and
that's
book what club
people
stuff.
Are. Yeah. That's what people are asking for. And so if you're not also up to speed, so I felt like I really got up to speed, like on an industry level on a bunch of stuff because of that, especially like when I worked at Chapters, that was a totally different thing because it was so big and people would come in and their expectations were quite high in one way. And then working in an independent bookstore, people's expectations are really high in a different way. Like they expect you to have a certain level of knowledge.
Yep, yep.
They expect you to judge them for buying things that are bad. Not me. I don't know what's bad. I mean, I do. We all know what it is. It's Elena Ferrante. So harsh.
I mean, is it Jonathan Franzen? I will say that shout out to Billy Nickerson who invited me to be at one of his events, Vancouver Writers Fest. Particularly,
it's good
point out that at that big event, which was my first really big one, my book had not been out for very long. Nobody knew who I was. And I remember going up on that stage at Performance Works, and there's a lot of people at Performance
Works.
It's
a big space.
It's a big space. And I remember making jokes and people laughing at them. And I thought, oh no, wait, I can do something else besides just write. I can perform. I can make people happy in a way that is separate, but also related to what I do, to my writing practice and who I am.
Yeah.
Right.
I felt the same way. Like it was Sean Cranberry that invited me to read at Real Vancouver Writer Series when it first started in 2010 during the Olympics. And that really was the first thing outside of being in my MFA cohort and other people that I knew in my writing group where I was actually in the community. Like mm-hmm. I was out of the cloister, you know? Yeah. And I can't.
I'm trying to come up with a good cloister name, and I'm like, this is the sisterhood.
We can work. We'll work
traveling on it. Words. That sucks, Jen.
We'll anyway, work on it.
Yeah.
And that definitely was a turning point in terms of that. So like giving people breaks, once you have the ability to do that, giving people opportunities is hugely important.
Making space is huge.
Yeah. If you can give people an opportunity and you can also help them with that opportunity, like, you know, just throwing people out on stage is fine. But if people have questions, you have to be open to that. You have to be open to people being vulnerable or being scared or being nervous and understanding that just because you're good at something doesn't mean that everyone else is A, going to be good at it, and B, want to do it and be comfortable. And it's not the old days of just jerks being like, well, we gave you a shot and it didn't work out, so get out of here, kid.
No, it's not like that.
It's not working for me.
It's not like that.
It's not like that.
I will say, like, people...
I mean, it shouldn't be like that. I'm sure it still is like that.
Well, I think it is. I think that...
But I think in the way that we are trying to...
Yeah.
Move through the world. And I hope other people are in the community.
And I will say, like, if you're looking for a role you can play, is that you never want to be anything other than yourself. You want to stay,
for sure,
true to what your interests are, what you can do. Like, don't ever try to be like someone else. Like, that's never going to work.
No.
So like when they asked me to be one of the debaters on Canada Reads 10 years ago now. Yeah. And it was hilarious. They're like, we need a writer celebrity. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll do it. Sure. I'm not that famous.
You're very famous.
Yeah. All right. It was, oh, great. And they asked me what book I wanted to defend. And I said Fruit by Brian Francis, friend of the podcast, Brian Francis, who we love. And they were like, we've never heard of this book. And they had to go look it up. And they're like, it's great. It's got like a 13-year-old boy with talking nipples. Who doesn't love this stuff? Right. And it felt like people were very surprised I chose that book. People had never heard of it. Like that book had done well for like independent press, but
I remember selling it.
Yeah. And then when it was on Canada Reads, people were like, we love this book. People love that book.
Yeah.
And I felt that was my first real taste of the idea of making space. Like, it's not about choosing something I wouldn't choose. It's not about defending a book that I didn't actually really like, because I did actually really like it. My question, Dina.
And this is going to be our final question, and then we're going to close it out.
Would you rewrite your first book if you had the chance?
I would revise my first book if I had the chance.
Like, how much of it, approximately?
I'm not going to lie to you. I feel like I did not get a sufficient amount of editing on that book. So there's definitely some stuff I would change, like on a line-by-line level.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think... I think there are poems that I wish that I had been able to include or finish to add to the manuscript, and some maybe that I would have removed.
Yeah.
I think I would have done a bit of restructuring, but the first half of the book I really love. I love all the otter poems, of course, but yeah, that part I think needed more. I just needed like a harsher edit.
Yeah.
I needed someone to be like, ///
Hey,
slash,
ding dong.
What the fuck
Change
is wrong with
this.
These line breaks? These line breaks are garbage. You need to fix this. So that is what I wish that I would be able to change. What about you?
No, you could not pay me to go back to the end of East, actually. It was one of those books that like I would never read again. It's one of those books that is like a relic of my past. Like, I couldn't even get there. Like, I was like 23 when I started writing it. I'm not going back there. It's bullshit.
Yeah, I still feel like... there is some relevance to that first book for me.
Yeah.
Well, and it's still like, again, as we talked about a lot in this episode, I have not matured. The themes I'm interested in have remained the same.
Oh,
like all those poems that I was writing about self-help culture and like emotionality. I'm still interested in that. Like, that is still something that is really important to me. It's reflected in a totally different way in my new book. So
I stand by the end
you
of
should.
Still.
It's a beautiful, amazing book.
Yeah, but it's very much, when I read it back now, it's just very much a book of my youth. And I don't think I could even revise it effectively at this point.
I do think that with fiction, it is very different. Like, even though I worked on those short stories for a long time,
mm-hmm.
from when I was young to when I was now-ish.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel the same.
Yeah.
Some of them, and I was lucky because I'd worked on it so long and it got published much later. So I could like, I took out a bunch of stories in there and I was able to revise things with like my more adult brain.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think if I rewrote The End of East now, it would become something totally different.
Like, I didn't get... Yeah, that publication I was talking about, my first publication, yeah. I was almost 30. So, like, I didn't publish it all in my 20s. Well, I was a real trash heap.
There's a part of me that wishes I hadn't in some ways, but which is ridiculous. I mean,
there's a part of me that wishes that I just could have been my most beautiful, most ingenuous self, parading myself around. But that didn't happen for me.
I don't know, man. Being in your 20s and like being paraded around as an ingenue also means that like weird stuff happens to you in,
yeah, of course.
In hospitality suite.
Guess what? Weird stuff happened to me anyway, just like as a bookseller. Like when I was a young writer and I went to that writer's festival event. It was like an offsite one that was not during the festival, mm-hmm. with Ian McEwan.
Oh, yeah.
Ian McEwan whispered in my ear, I thought you were the Portuguese girl I was waiting for. And then I was like, well, I'm going to leave. And all my friends everyone was meeting him and it was very exciting. And then a bunch of my friends went out for drinks and they're like, we're going out for drinks with Ian and this and that. And I was like, I will see you later. I just went right home.
There's a part of me that wishes you just pretended to have been the Portuguese girl.
I just,
and then
in the
moment, him.
Was, well, also, here's what. The event was, like, very boring. I didn't think it was very good. No offense, Ian McEwan, I don't think you're
was
very
it
good.
Was it in a church?
Was in a big church.
I think I was there.
It was boring. Mm-hmm. The interview was boring. I don't want to say who interviewed, but I feel like it was very boring. And I was not engaged on that level either. So then I was kind of groggy at the end of it when I was surprised by this being mistaken.
I mean,
this young Portuguese woman.
I think I was at that event. Honestly.
I mean, I think a lot of people were. It was a hugely packed event. Like, I'm sure everyone in the literary community was there.
I wish I'd known you then.
Yeah.
I would have kicked him in the balls.
I just was like, I got to get out of here. I don't want to talk to this little troll man. I got to leave.
Maybe he would have whispered to me. I thought you were the Japanese girl.
Oh, my God. Probably. Could have been. You could have been Japanese. You could have been Vietnamese, Jen.
I could have been anything.
You could have been Portuguese, yeah. too. Like, who knows? So anyway, that's where I'm going to leave us on that great note. But we love baby writers and, you know, you can always tweet at us.
Tweet at us and then we'll address it on the podcast.
Yeah. We'd love to hear about your experiences or if you have questions. We're now obviously doing our questions from Twitter segment. Mm-hmm. And so we'd love to answer your questions.
Questions from Twitter.
Thank you so much, Jen. Good to talk to you.
Always good to talk to you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.